For the week of December 10th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 392, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, dodging terrorist attacks and a cold, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, I'm sorry you're sick, Michael.
Yeah, I'm a little run down, a little cold, a little sniffy, a little flu-y, a little head congestion, but I'll survive.
Well, you wouldn't want to be here in Los Angeles or Southern California for that matter.
The roof is on fire.
That's true. Not only the roof, but apparently the entire area, the entire vicinity.
Yes. Yeah, so people are fleeing. They're fleeing on foot, in cars and boats and planes and trains, but they can still listen to a podcast while they flee, can't they?
As a matter of fact, they probably should listen to a podcast as they flee to take their mind off of all the world's worries. Although we've got some world's worries on today's episode.
Such as?
This week on Showbiz Sandbox, it's really mystery time. We're going to discuss the cases of the missing director and the missing short. First, Bryan Singer is being fired from a new film because he stopped showing up on the set. There's your missing director. Last week, we talked about the animated short Olaf's Frozen Adventure from, you know, Disney was pulling it from movie theaters, where it was playing in front of Coco. Now, where has it appeared? The answer is as easy as ABC. Also, another few award groups have weighed in with their picks for the best films of the year, including, by the way, the Golden Globes. On Inside Baseball, we've got the latest in the sexual misconduct scandals that have been plaguing, well, humanity, really. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes, and also we get info from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is Coco, the Pixar Disney animated film. $73 million on the weekend, $390 million worldwide. It's in about two-thirds of all the territories around the world, so we've got quite a few weeks before the full total is done here. We're looking at, you know, January, February, March before all the money is in. It's doing especially well in China. Had a good opening weekend. It doubled its gross the second weekend. And the third weekend, it held pretty steady, only dropped a little bit. I think it made about $38 million in the Middle Kingdom alone. So it's really tearing it up in China. It may pass its gross here in North America pretty soon. So that is proving, as again, we've been waiting for that to become the biggest box office market in the world. It may be the biggest one right now for Coco.
Well, when you think about it, it makes sense, right? I mean, you can take children to see it. It's probably dubbed into Chinese. Okay.
Well, of course. Mandarin or Cantonese, yes.
Well, yes. Thank you.
Or perhaps the written language is different than the phonetic, so I don't even know about that. But yes, of course, it's dubbed in multiple languages.
Well, and it might be easier for some people within that population, within any population, to just listen to the dubbed track rather than read subtitles. And in this case, with children, of course, it's much easier.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, number two around the world is Murder on the Orient Express. Another $25 million on the weekend, $275 million worldwide. This movie is proving a big, big success internationally. You got a big international cast. You cast it with an eye to the world, and it's certainly paying off. It's going to double probably what it makes in North America around the world. And number three is Justice League, another $25 million. That's at $615 million worldwide. And number four is Paddington 2, $21 million on the weekend, $70 million worldwide, where we don't know yet quite what it costs to make, but probably around $60 million, just like the original. And number five is Wonder, the family drama co-starring Julia Roberts about a little boy with a facial deformity who goes to school. It is the heartwarming hit of the fall. $20 million on the weekend, $130 million worldwide, and it's just getting going.
And, you know, based on a book that did rather well. So
it's the best-selling young adult novel, absolutely. And number six is Daddy's Home 2 with Mark Wahlberg and Will Ferrell. Another $17 million. That's at $140 million worldwide. So they finally doubled their budget, hoping to crawl their way closer to tripling it.
Does this bring back Mel Gibson? Is he back in everybody's good graces now?
Well, he directed the war film that people were polite to. He's in this. So I don't know about good graces, but he is working invisible. Maybe it gives all the people who are being accused of sexual misconduct a happy thought as they deal with maybe 5 years down the road, I can be in a movie again. And number seven is Thor Ragnarok, which I didn't even think about it, but apparently the way we're pronouncing it is sort of interesting.
Yes, Raul Buril via Twitter, at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle there, at Showbiz Sandbox. He said that we've gone all in by pronouncing it Thor Ragnarok instead of Thor Ragnarok.
Which is the way it should be said. I don't know how I got into Ragnarok, and I kept meaning to play the trailer to see if they say the name Ragnarok in the trailer or something.
Well, you saw the movie, so isn't that even better?
Well, I have seen the movie, but I don't remember how often they said the word Ragnarok or Rack or Rick. So now I don't know how to say it. At number 8 is A Bad Mom's Christmas, $115 million worldwide. And number 9 is The Disaster Artist, opening in 4 territories, but mostly North America. It's had a great expansion this weekend. This is the James Franco comedy. Got some Golden Globe nominations and some love from the Critics' Choice Awards. It made $7 million on the weekend. It's just under $10 million. At number 10, our first international film, The Big Call. This is a Chinese crime drama directed by the older of the Pang brothers. Those are the guys behind the I franchise. It made $5 million on its opening weekend. Right below that is another really solid success story. This is that animated film about Vincent van Gogh called Loving Vincent. And it's the film that was hand-drawn. They sort of created the entire film in the style of Van Gogh. And if you see the film, it's visually striking. Almost everybody says, well, it's not a great movie, but it's awfully cool looking. And it's apparently working really well worldwide because it's really tearing it up overseas. It made another $4.6 million on the weekend, and it's just under $25 million worldwide. That's a great result for a movie that cost $5 million to make. A labor of love, and they've really, really had a success with it. Again, another film that's mentioned in the Golden Globes and has Oscar hopes in the future.
And actually, at the Annie Award nominations,
oh, right.
This week, well, first of all, Disney picked up 33 nominations, including 13 for Coco. I think the other nominations, what were the other nominations for? Maybe
TV and stuff? I don't know.
I don't know. But DreamWorks was second most honored with 22 nominations. But they actually, in 2015, started a different category. They have an independent category now. And Loving Vincent was nominated in that category, along with In This Corner of the World, Napping Princess, The Big Bad Fox and Other Tales, and The Breadwinner. This is a movie that takes place in Afghanistan, and I'll tell you, it's on everybody's best animated film of the year list.
Which one?
The Breadwinner.
Oh, The Breadwinner, yes, yes. That's from G-Kids, who have had great success in the last few years. Back to the box office. 47 Meters Down is in another territory. It's past the $60 million mark. The Star, the animated film about the birth of Jesus, that is past the $32 million mark. Lady Bird, that had a great week with nominations and such. That's at $22 million as well, as is The Swindlers, a Korean heist flick. That's at $25 million worldwide. One movie that's not doing so well is the senior drama comedy, What's Going On in Just Getting Started. I know it stars Morgan Freeman, Rene Russo, and Tommy Lee Jones, but I know it didn't do well at the box office, but I have no idea what it's about.
Yeah, neither does anybody, apparently. It's Jim Amos over at Celluloid Junkie. He said that he'd have to rack his brain to remember the last time a movie opened broadly. Okay, it was the only big broad opening on over 2,000 screens.
Oh, I see, yeah.
And that it barely broke the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
In North America, I should say.
That's correct. It's in 4 territories, but mostly North America is what we're talking about. Right below that is a new French film. It's Santa and C. I'm not sure how to say the female's name, but it's a French family film about Santa Claus looking for a cure to help his sick elves and save Christmas. It's written and directed and starring Alain Chabat, and it opened to about $3.3 million in France. The Italian comedy Perfect Strangers made another $3 million on the weekend. That's the movie with the awful idea that you should have dinner with your friends and put your cell phones in the middle of the table and say, oh, let's see who's calling and texting everyone because we have nothing to hide. I wouldn't do that with myself. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri is at $18 million. Happy Death Day is at $112 million. Scrolling down, there's another new movie. I think there's 2 new movies left. One is Mary and the Witch's Flower. That's a Japanese animated film, maybe anime, I'm not sure, based on the British children's book by Mary Stewart. It's been playing. Apparently, it opened in Japan. I think maybe it opened up in China. It's in some territory right now, made another $2 million. Its total is $30 million. I believe it opened up in Japan in July, and I'm not sure if it's made it to the U.S. yet, but that's a new Japanese animated film based on the British children's book by Mary Stewart. And a little bit below that is a pretty lame-looking movie called Pororo, Dinosaur Island Adventure, which is a Korean animated film spun off from a TV series about an adorable penguin and his dinosaur friends. And that made about $2 million on its opening weekend. I'm sure it's not a big budget film looking at the trailer, but that's all I know about it. If you know about Pororo or Marrying the Witch's Flower and have some info to share, reach out to us.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox is our handle, as I mentioned. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. And we do actually check and, you know, reach out to those who contact us via Facebook and Twitter all the time. So please do write, text, email.
Rate, review.
Yes. Do all. Just get in touch with us. We're just lonely, really, is what it
is. Very, very lonely. And I was so lonely, I stayed at home and watched Olaf's Frozen Adventure on ABC last night. So ABC had a short, Disney had a short spun off from Frozen, airing in front of Coco. But it was 21 minutes long. It was so long, people complained. It was also really, really bad. So people complained. It was bad. They yanked it from theaters. Because it was so unusually long, 21 minutes, you go, I bet next year they were planning to show this movie on TV as a holiday special. It's a Christmas-themed short tied into Frozen. It would sort of help promote the 2019 release of Frozen 2. And I think they just ended up doing this 1 year early.
So it's going to debut on December 14th. So obviously you're a time traveler because you're going ahead in time.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I thought it aired last night.
No,
it's going to air on ABC.
Yes.
Ah, well, there I'm getting cute. I'd already seen it in the theaters. I wasn't going to watch it twice. Just kidding.
But you know who probably will watch it twice is Disney's Bob Iger. You might know him as the CEO of Disney. And he keeps saying, every time I try to get out, they pull me back in. Because, you know, he keeps trying to retire. He keeps saying, this is it. There's no way, nothing you can say that is going to make me extend my contract past insert year here, because he's already extended it once or twice before. And now his contract lasts through 2019. And, you know, he has been said to, there's no way at all he will extend past that. Unless we happen to buy 20th Century Fox, in which case I will extend past 2019.
Because they want him to deal with the big problem of swallowing up that company and figuring it all out and making the merger work.
Right.
He's about as reluctant to stay on as I am reluctant to sing at the holiday Christmas party. So sure, they're cajoling him, but it's not that hard.
So you're saying you can't wait to sing at the holiday Christmas party.
I love that. You try and stop me. So he's having a happy time because Marvel is firing on all cylinders. Pixar is firing on all cylinders. The sexual harassment scandals haven't quite reached Disney yet, even though they have Weinstein and the head of Pixar and their animation division both tainted by this. Nonetheless, Disney still remains rosy, and they can just laugh all the way at the bank while poor Warner Brothers tries to figure out what to do about their DC universe.
Yeah, I guess after Justice League stumbled out of the gate, they're kind of like, what do we do here? And so what's the verdict? Nobody knows, really. They just know that.
Well, they're going to shake it up. The people in charge are not going to be in charge. They're going to have it be less autonomous than, say, Marvel is. They want it to be more integrated into the Warner Brothers family. And they're just, putting new people in charge and saying, this isn't working. We need to do something new.
Didn't they do that right after Batman versus Superman? They did the same thing. Every time a movie stumbles, they're like, that's it. Nope, we're changing it.
We're shaking things up.
Yeah. We're putting the people that used to be in charge back in charge.
Funnily enough, I would say if you had to compare Marvel and DC and who's doing a better job quality-wise, I would say Fox and X-Men.
Which is a Marvel property.
Yes, but they're not in charge of it.
But I remember when the very first X-Men was released in the early 2000s, and everybody thought, well, this, you know, comic book movie and Spider-Man and, you know, and okay, it'll be all right. And it was a huge hit.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of a surprise. Directed by Bryan Singer.
That's right. And he has had a crazy week. First, all we knew was that He didn't show up on the set of a new movie, a biomusical about the rock band Queen. It's called Bohemian Rhapsody, after their most iconic hit. And he just didn't show up. And you're like, what the heck is going on there? Then we found out he's had this problem before of just not showing up or showing up late regularly. And the studio was aware of this and actually concerned about it. And as the last week was winding down and we were doing the show, I was making a note to myself, oh, you know what? All this weird stuff is happening and it's happened before. But Bryan Singer has also had troubles with sexual misconduct allegations in the past. So I thought, I wonder if any of that's linked. And it's not quite linked, but it is all a big mess coming up this 1 week. So what's been going on?
Well, as you mentioned, Bryan Singer didn't show up on set of Bohemian Rhapsody after the Thanksgiving break here in the United States. Now, the film is being shot in the UK. 20th Century Fox told him, you know what? Hey, don't bother coming back because you're fired, actually. And then later in the week, he was, I don't know whether, was he charged or was, did I guess a civil lawsuit was filed against him.
Yes.
Saying that he forcibly raped a 17-year-old back in 2003.
Right. So bad week for Bryan Singer. I just find it bizarre that he would just not show up. And his explanation, which raised eyebrows, was that they wouldn't let me take care of an ailing parent. Which is A, yes, of course. You said my parent is dying. And they said, oh, who cares? Make the movie. As if something wouldn't be done. And B, what do you mean? Like, you would say my mother or my father. You wouldn't say an ailing parent. Like, that alone sounds bizarre to me. That you would say, my dad is dying. That's what you would say. My dad is sick. You don't say, I have an ailing parent. That just doesn't make any sense. So that weird withholding of which parent it was raised an eyebrow for me. I hate to doubt it. Maybe his parent is not well. I certainly hope they are. But again, this was not something that happened over Thanksgiving. This happened throughout the shoot. He would show up late. He wouldn't show up at all. They met with him and said, this isn't acceptable. People came to the set and watched. And then he didn't show up again after Thanksgiving. And now suddenly he says, oh, I've got an ailing parent. I'm sorry if I don't buy that excuse. God forbid his parent not be well, but that doesn't make any sense. That sounds like BS. And now he's got this problem. So he's really, I mean, they've locked him out of his Fox offices. They hired a new director for the last 2 weeks. That's Dexter Fletcher, who did the British film Eddie the Eagle. I think that starred Hugh Jackman.
Yeah.
And USC has removed his name from the film school until allegations are resolved. He gave them tons of money and they put his name on a film school. And again, excuse me, but I just think it's bizarre if you're a living person like David Geffen or Bryan Singer and you want your name on a building. That's just weird to me. I would say name it the Orson Welles School or whatever name hasn't been used yet. I wouldn't want it named after me. That's just a creepy thing in general. But that's just me.
Well, the Geffen Playhouse, look at that.
I think it's creepy and bizarre. I would say name it the Eugene O'Neill Playhouse, whatever playwright I loved. I would say name it after them. I wouldn't want it named after me. And Brian, who's a Jew here? Is Bryan Singer a Jew?
I don't know.
Isn't Bryan Singer a Jew? I think he's a Jew. And Jews are not supposed to put their names on things. That's like, actually, you don't do that culturally. So there you go. But well, anyway, I just think it's weird in general. Somebody who wants to do that to me is an odd duck right away.
Well, I'm sure I've told you this story where when we launched Film Stew, we were based in Culver City, right down the street, same block, within like 60 seconds walk of the Kirk Douglas Theater, but it was called the Culver City Theater. Okay, it was an old, you know, movie house, and it was vacant for decades, you know, at least 10-15 years. And one day I'm walking to lunch and the doors are open and I'm thinking, oh, I want to go inside there. You know, the front doors of this place are never open. I'd love to see inside there. So I'm about to take a step in and who should pop out of the doorway but Kirk Douglas and a whole entourage full of people. And they walk past me and right into a black like SUV that's pulling up. And he's very animated and talking to people. And I'm thinking, wow, that was kind of weird. Kirk Douglas walking out. Well, within the year, they reopened that theater, refurbished, named it the Kirk Douglas Theater. And just this past weekend, he celebrated his 101st birthday.
That's right. December 9th was his birthday. And a friend on Facebook posted the day before. They said, oh, he died. What a shame. I go, what? And I looked it up. I'm like, I don't see that he died. And she's like, oh, I got it wrong. He's alive. Yay.
Yeah. I thought at the time, I thought, well, you know, because he had already had the stroke. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I thought for a guy who had a stroke, he's moving around quite well. He's a little bit more active than me. And I'm in my, you know, 30s. And I thought, you know, you're putting your name on a theater. Is that kind of jinxing yourself?
And apparently not.
Apparently not. Exactly.
Well, you know, and he, of course, is an Oscar voter. I'm sure he'll be filling out his ballot. Like, he's like, yes, another year I get to fill out an Oscar ballot. He's probably filled out more than almost anyone in Hollywood right now. And I'm sure he's paying attention to the Golden Globes. What happened there?
Well, the Golden Globes were, the nominations were announced. And this is always that time of year when you kind of roll your eyes and go, oh, geez. Can you believe that, I don't know, what was the big Johnny Depp movie that the Tourist, I think, was nominated as a comedy and was not a comedy? Okay, so Golden Globe nominations, Best Picture Drama, Call Me By Your Name, Dunkirk, The Post, The Shape of Water, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Now, The Shape of Water, which got kind of middling reviews here in the United States, got the most nominations.
And here's where your joke comes in. Best Comedy or Musical, The Disaster Artist, Get Out, The Greatest Showman, I, Tonya, and Lady Bird. Which one of these is not like the other?
Well, I would say Get Out, the horror film.
That's right. Yeah, Get Out. I mean, it does have some satire and some sly humor in it, but it's really basically a drama. It's not like Scream, say, where the horror film was imbued with humor and jokes. No. It's a horror film and really doesn't belong in comedy or musical, but then neither does The Greatest Showman, which I'm just assuming from the trailer is pretty god-awful.
Yeah. Isn't that, God, who?
That's Hugh Jackman.
And Baz Luhrmann.
No, it's not Baz Luhrmann.
Okay. I don't know why I thought that was Baz Luhrmann.
It just feels like, so of course, as always, there are people who get nominated who you say, oh my gosh, I can't believe they got nominated. And others who didn't, you say, oh my gosh, I can't believe they didn't. You know, women did not do well under the Golden Globes. Wonder Woman did not get nominated. None of the women who might have been nominated for Best Director, including Greta Gerwig and Patty Jenkins and Dee Reese, none of them got nominated. It's an all-male body. It's Guillermo del Toro, Martin McDonagh, Christopher Nolan, Ridley Scott, and Steven Spielberg. So, you know, that's just tea leave reading right until we get up to the Oscars.
Right, and then you have things like, you know, Roman J. Israel, Denzel Washington being nominated for Best Performance by an Actor in a Motion Picture Drama. And you kind of go, okay, I haven't seen the film. I'm sure he's very good in it. He's very good in most films that he's in. But remember, this is the same body, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which puts on this party called the Golden Globes that likes to have a few stars show up.
Well, that doesn't sound like an outrage to me, as opposed to where, like, The Tourist. It's not a great year for male performances. It seems to me there's a lot of room. We shall see. I mean, the best actors in a musical or comedy are Steve Carell for Battle of the Sexes, which no one cares about anymore, Ansel Elgort for Baby Driver, James Franco for The Disaster Artist, Hugh Jackman for The Greatest Showman, and Daniel Kaluuya, how do you say his name?
Kaluuya.
And Daniel Kaluuya for Get Out. I'd say only two of them have any shot, James Franco and Daniel, for the best actor nomination. But we'll see.
I hope I pronounced his name right, because of course you asked me and then I pronounced it as if I knew what I was talking about.
And I believed you. And we've got the same thing with the critics' choices, right? I mean, they've got movies nominated and some of them, you know, help keep the ball rolling on your way to an Oscar nomination. Whereas the Golden Globes ignored the Big Sick, the critics' choice said that's one of the best films of the year.
Yeah, and I think it is one of the best films of the year, but apparently we mispronounced Daniel Kaluuya's name because they're coming to arrest you right now. I can hear them in the background.
I turned on the mute button so you wouldn't hear the sirens anymore. But, you know, we did just have a terrorist attack. So they have blocked off a number of streets around the Port Authority bus terminal. The bomb went off early. Unfortunately, a few people were injured, but thank God it wasn't worse, I guess.
Yes, live and breaking news. Yes, so you're talking about the Critics' Choice Awards here. The Big Sick, one of my favorite films from the year. Call Me By Your Name, Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, The Florida Project. Again, one of my favorite films of the year. Get Out, Lady Bird, The Post, The Shape of Water, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. So I don't know. I mean, do all of these win or do they pick one later? I don't really.
No, they name a best film of the year. Last year, they named La La Land as the best film of the year. They will have an awards ceremony and pick a winner. Of course they will.
Yeah, because it's it used to be called the Broadcast Critics Awards. I don't know what, you know, I don't know what group is doing that anymore.
Well, as far as I can tell, one thing is clear. Oscar has expanded its nominations to a rotating size from 5 to 10. The Golden Globes have always got 10 nominations. All these critic groups, the National Board of Review, Critics' Choice, a lot of people have 10 films on their Best of the Year list, which I think is reasonable. I think we're seeing basically, again, as often happens, all these small films that some people think are good, and big, fat studio movies are not in the running except for Dunkirk.
Yes, you know, I mean, that seemed to be a given.
The Oscars to try to get movies like Wonder Woman, and there aren't really that many good, you know, broad movies this year. Wonder Woman and Dunkirk are about it, but I don't think Wonder Woman's going to make the cut.
I don't think so either.
Yeah, so it looks like another year where the Oscars will be dominated by small art films. But, you know, that's what you're going to do. Those are the best films of the year as far as they see it. So, I mean, Call Me By Your Name and The Big Sick and Lady Bird are, you know, shaped up into nice solid hits. You know, given their budgets, they're really big success stories, but they're not big studio films like Dunkirk. Hollywood is just not in the business of making good movies anymore, and they just have to accept that fact.
Well,
there's
no way
you can rig the nominations to give them awards for movies that aren't that good.
Well, and they're certainly not in the business of making big, giant blockbuster films that don't have men in tights or women in tights. So, you know, when you think about it, okay, what other movie, what other big blockbuster would it be? Would it be Batman or the Justice League, or would it be the you know,
Thor Ragnarok?
Yeah,
it be Thor Ragnarok, or could it be Thor Ragnarick?
Yeah,
you know, there's no telling what it could be.
Or Wonder Woman. It's like, okay, so if you look at that and you start talking about, well, which movie could it have been? Well, I mean, even if you wanted to nominate a big animated film, like, I don't know, the Lego
Coco.
Movie Batman, it's like...
Or Coco.
Okay, Coco, yes. But I mean...
I didn't like it, actually. I thought it was a poor film, but that is certainly a well-reviewed big film. There's no reason that couldn't be in the mix of the best pictures of the year in terms of Oscar, but it won't be.
No.
Get Out, maybe, is their best hope for... And that's a small film, but at least it has popular appeal. The main thing is they want people to watch, and they want people to watch and to recognize some of the films as big, fat commercial hits, like Get Out and Wonder Woman. Will they do it this year? We'll have to wait and see. We know they're going to keep making those big movies, and that's why this week in reboots, we've got A Geek Paradise of Quentin Tarantino and J.J. Abrams teaming up.
Yes. Now, you might think, okay, what could they possibly be working on together? And when I tell you, you're just going to be like, what? Get this. It's a Star Trek spinoff. Or it's a Star Trek movie. It's a Star Trek movie, okay? Because Quentin Tarantino had an idea for a Star Trek movie, and he pitched it to Paramount. But of course, he's not going to write it. He has J.J. Abrams kind of coming in and tweaking things. Because of course, J.J. Abrams has so much free time these days, directing the third of these Star Wars sequels. I guess it would be a sequel. Episode 9 he's directing. He's totally got time to work on another space opera movie, Star Trek.
Well, a couple things. J.J. Abrams is linked to both Star Trek and Star Wars. Quentin Tarantino has always been a Star Trek fan. He's always talked passionately about this show. He loves the show. If you're thinking about big franchises where he would jump in, I think the two are James Bond or Star Trek. So it's not a bizarre where did that come from fit. You can hear him talking about his favorite episode and Kirk and Spock. I mean, he really is a Star Trek geek. So it makes sense. The thing that I found depressing was because it is a big studio tentpole film, even when you have an auteur, someone like Quentin Tarantino who writes and directs all his films, even when you have someone like him with what he thinks is a great idea for Star Trek, the first thing they do is not say, great, write a script. It's let's set up a writer's room.
Right, exactly.
That's why these movies suck, because you've got 10 guys in a room, probably one chick if she's lucky, and they are shooting the breeze, and so what if we do that? It's like, that is not a way to create a good movie.
Well, and you say one chick if she's lucky. These days, she might not be so lucky.
Yeah, really, but let's save that for Inside Baseball.
Well, Inside Baseball comes right after Big Deal or Big Whoop. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. When you see a famous boldface name in a headline or email subject line or Twitter trending topic or a text from a friend, your first thought is, oh God, what did they do? So maybe it's natural that when John Travolta's biopic Gotti disappeared from the Lionsgate release schedule just days before its December 15th release in theaters and on VOD, people thought, oh, geez, what did someone connected with the movie do and who was it? But nope. Says producers, the real reason it got pulled is because the movie is actually good. The film's backers raised $50 million because the early screenings went so well. Instead of dumping it via a micro-release label handled by Lionsgate, They bought back the movie from Lionsgate for $4.5 million to secure U.S. rights, and now they plan a proper theatrical release. That's it, really. There's no scandal behind it, other than the fact that it's about Gotti. But that's another story. Big deal or big whoop?
Yeah, I don't know why you'd make a film with John Travolta playing Gotti and want to just dump it video on demand day and date.
Unless it's bad.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. But I mean, that seemed to be the plan, whether it was good or bad.
Yes, that is correct.
That's what I don't understand. But, well, we'll have to wait and see. When the movie comes out, we'll find out whether they're right or just feeling lucky.
The UK exhibitor Cineworld is acquiring the North American giant Regal. Regal Cinemas, owned by Regal Entertainment Group. This is being done in a reverse takeover valued at $3.6 billion in cash. It's actually valued more than that. It's like in the $5 billion range. But
they have some debt, right?
Right. But so it's a $3.6 billion cash offer.
Regal, and it's like kind of like a reverse takeover would be like us taking over NPR. Is that the idea?
Yes. Well, yes, because, you know, the smaller company is buying the bigger company here.
Right, right.
So Regal has until January 22nd to look for a better offer. It's called a go shop period. And they have that time before the deal actually goes through. Cineworld has more than 2,200 screens in 9 European countries, while Regal, and here's what you're talking about, Michael, has more than 7,300 screens in the U.S. and its territories. When it comes to exhibition, bigger is better, right? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I know exactly what I think. I think I should ask you.
Well, look, you know, this is an opportunistic purchase, okay? So there's no doubt about that.
Is there any other kind?
Well, you know, sometimes you are just looking to grow and acquire a company, and it's going to cost you a little bit to do it. And it's not because the pound is down, and so that's when AMC purchased, Odeon.
Why is Regal on the selling block?
Well, because the stock price is down. The stock price has dropped, you know, between 35 and 50% this year. And so Cineworld can come in and purchase, make a purchase in dollars. And, you know, they're in the EU, so the exchange rate is good. The stock price is, you know, priced at a takeover rate. And, you know, Mookie Greidinger is the head of Cineworld. He started Cinema City. Which he started it out of, I believe, Israel. He kind of took over the Central European exhibition chains there. He kind of became a big deal in the Middle East and Central and Eastern Europe. He took over Cineworld, and now Cineworld is taking over, will take over Regal, unless...
Is it a good deal or not? Are you happy? Is it? It's fine? It makes sense?
You know, look, this is the way motion picture exhibition is going to go. Who predicted this, by the way, was George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, but they kind of said that this was going to happen.
What?
That you know, scale, that you would get these big, giant...
When did George Lucas talk about theater exhibition?
When they were at that USC...
They were talking about budgets of movies, and they said Hollywood should stop making big-budget movies and start making really small-budget movies. They'd be better off making 100 films for $2 million each rather than one film for $200 million. I don't remember them talking about exhibitors.
And they talked about how, you know, going to the movies will be, like, you know, very expensive, and there won't be movie theaters, as many movie theaters. I disagree with them on that. I think there
will, and they're wrong. This isn't an example of that.
I think there will be, movie theaters, because, look, people need to go on dates. They need to go someplace. As long as people need to get together and socialize, there'll be, whether it's a movie theater or a theater or some type of communal entertainment experience, there will be something like a movie theater. The reason that you see this happening is the same reason that you see all, you know, Disney purchasing 20th Century Fox. Scale, scale, scale. If you want to have any leverage whatsoever in negotiations for your product, you need to be a large player, whether it's Costco or Walmart or Ketty Four. You need to have some type of scale to turn to your supplier and say, hey, let's negotiate better terms.
Well, I don't know about that. I think, do you want to be a film theater chain in just Texas? Or just Florida? Or do you want to be across North America? And today, box office is a worldwide business. So if box office is down in France and Germany, if you also have theaters in Spain and Japan, you're going to balance out the ups and downs that happen territory by territory and market by market. So I think it just makes sense that you know, this cinema chain is strong in Europe and weak in the U.S. and Regal is strong in the U.S. and weak in Europe. So they've combined.
Regal is strong in the U.S. and non-existent in Europe. So
right. Well, there you go. Exactly. So it's a good fit. It's not something where you're just where Disney is buying up Fox and you're just buying up something that you already kind of have just to get their library. You know, it's not like you're combining film and TV or you have a TV and you buy another TV. This is an actual thing that makes sense. And again, I don't know why the stock market is down on theater exhibitors. Nothing has happened in the last 2 years to make you say, oh my God, nobody's going to go to the theater anymore. Because last year was the highest grossing year of all time. And this year will probably be the second highest grossing year of all time. Sounds like a good, mature business. You're not going to have 30% growth in North America. That's crazy. But it's a great business, dependable, strong, and things look good.
Well, and I was this news kind of broke about 2 weeks ago. When Regal had to kind of make an announcement that, yes, they were in talks with Cineworld, and if they came to any fruition, they would, you know, make another announcement. And it was that was mentioned after, I think it was the Wall Street Journal or Bloomberg let leak that Cineworld was talking to Regal about an acquisition. And I thought, was it a leak or was it a purposeful leak? Because, you know, it seemed like Regal was saying, you know what, we want to see how much we can get. And so, you know, just selling to Cineworld, we'd like to have other offers on the table.
Because their stock has dropped 30 to 50% and they feel like, hey, when we were worth more just a month ago, why, you know, we're not suddenly worth half what we were a year ago.
Right.
And the value is there. So, yeah, fair enough. They'll see if they get more and then we'll find out.
Right. Okay. And so they have this go shop period put into
it. Of course. Yeah. And you just wanted to say, the name Mookie.
You know, Mookie Greidinger? Yeah, he's a character. He's a character in the exhibition world, that's for sure. But so is Alec Baldwin, by the way. Not in the exhibition world. He's just a character. He plays lots of them on television, movies, and elsewhere. But Alec Baldwin, he just can't stop talking. Sometimes that's gotten him into trouble, by the way. But lately, the Emmy-winning actor is talking on a radio show for WNYC called Here's the Thing. The plan is to turn that into a TV talk show for ABC, though where it might air is anyone's guess. After Kimmel, in daytime, frankly, Baldwin doesn't feel like a daytime talk show host, and he's already hosting the game show Match Game in prime time. All we know is that it won't air live on Saturday nights because he'll still probably pop on over to NBC to play President Trump right through the impeachment hearings. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? Guy gets job. But I guess he's been pre-disastered. So the unpleasantness in his divorces and audio tapes and stuff with his kid and all that, I guess we've already heard all that. So they're thinking nothing worse will come out down the road.
Yeah, I mean, we already know how Alec Baldwin behaves. We have the proof. Eminem has a new album out December 15th, hot on the heels of his most political single to date, the ferocious Trump Putdown, that told his fans if they support Trump, then they should stop listening to Eminem. He doesn't want them. Will that hurt sales or help them? Sales? Wait, I mean streaming. Will that hurt or help streaming of the album, dubbed Revival? It includes appearances by Beyonce, Pink, Alicia Keys, and Ed Sheeran, among others. I'm surprised Taylor Swift isn't thrown into the mix there. Big album sales are a thing of the past, probably, but Eminem would at least like to dominate the culture again, and Revival is his most focused attempt to do so in years. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? He has an album coming out. That's his job. That's what he does. What's interesting to me is that it comes out on Friday, December 15th. And for a while now, I've been noticing and recognizing, but not putting it together, that album release dates are now Fridays. They used to be on Tuesday because they would get the physical product in a record store, have it there and have it ready, and then it would sell through the weekend. You would show up at a record store on Tuesday if you were a real geek to see what was there, and the casual fans could show up Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and they would be in the next week. You'd find out the sales. Nowadays, because of streaming, they've moved away from Tuesday. It doesn't make any sense anymore. They want to release new albums on Friday when people are getting ready for the weekend and are ready to listen to something new, and so now albums drop on Friday. So it's kind of funny. Movies open up on Thursdays instead of Friday. Albums open up on Friday instead of Tuesday. Books still come out on Tuesday, but you can do it Monday night at midnight if you're on a Kindle.
Well, this has actually been the case for years now. And on Spotify, they have, you know, New Music Friday or whatever it's called. They have a whole playlist of new music every Friday. Release
That's right. And it's a sea change back from what was the standard for, you know, 20 years, 30 years in the music industry.
Yeah. And I think something else that streaming has allowed for is the use of profanity. And it seems every song has profanity in it now. because you don't have to worry about whether it's played on the radio.
True.
Of course, Eminem has videos on YouTube promoting his new album, but will the album be available on YouTube's new music service? Yes, the video website is taking another stab at launching a paid music subscription service. They've already got Warner Brothers on board and have been talking for the past year with Universal, which is Eminem's label, by the way, Sony, and the indie consortium Merlin. The service is expected to launch in March and follows previous attempts for a paid service such as Google Play Music in 2011, YouTube Music Key in 2014, and YouTube Red in 2016. All of those services, by the way, are still around. Okay, that's how confusing this is. Remix, the new service includes on-demand streaming a la Spotify, videos, and more. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess I'll know when I find out what the heck it is. It was hard to even figure out what exactly they're going to be offering in what way, shape, or form. So I'm just scratching my head. Okay, you got it. What is it?
You know what? You look at that would be the fourth music service or streaming service to come out of Google. Or one of Google's companies in some way, shape, or form. I think mixed up is exactly what you could say Google is when it comes to this kind of stuff. Now, the best-selling young adult author John Green has a new book on the charts, and I'm trying to get my kids to read this book. It's called Turtle All the Way Down. It's one of the big hits of the fall, mixing up obsessive compulsive disorder with a road trip and, of course, romance in his usual blockbuster style. Because Green's last book was The Fault in Our Stars, the basis for a hit film, by the way, we assumed his new book was already snapped up by Hollywood. But wait, Green held back the rights and held discussions with many studios. Nonetheless, after weeks of talks, he ended up signing with the Los Angeles Angels. He ended up right where he began, at Fox, the studio that turned The Fault in Our Stars into a worldwide smash, and also did right by his book, Paper Towns. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, well, it's a big deal. I mean, it's good to look around and talk to other people, but, you know, you worked with them twice. You were happy with it. I'm always kind of glad when people don't dump their agent after having their biggest hit ever or something like that. So, you know, it was nice to see that he valued the relationship and was smart enough to look around, but decided that was where he should stay.
You know, I wonder when I make kind of inside jokes like that about, you know, American sports teams, whether our international listeners know what the heck I'm talking about.
I'm sure they got it. They're on top of it. They're smart people.
True. Now, it's official, Michael. The Broadway League and casting directors, they are officially at war. As we've discussed, casting directors are recognized by the film and TV industry as a union. But while many of the same companies produce shows on Broadway, in the theater world, the owners and producers refuse to acknowledge the casting directors as a union, keeping them from the same basic rights and benefits as actors, directors, costumers, stagehands, musicians, and so on. They've been at loggerheads for years, and now it's come to a head. Casting directors and their Teamsters, the Teamsters Local 817, actually, have been holding rallies and handing out flyers to draw support. They're ready to work on shows, but anytime an offer is made, they insist the deal be made through their union. And now the Broadway League is suing some major casting companies for acting as a cartel. Amidst a record-breaking year of grosses and record-high ticket prices on Broadway, the theater owners and producers accuse the casting directors of being greedy and trying to drive up the cost of making a Broadway show, threatening the livelihood of actors and stagehands and the like. You know, all
they
those
just care about the little guy.
Yeah. All those people that you just mentioned, they're in unions, by the way. In response, the casting directors say they just want the same workplace rights and health care as everyone else who works on a show. A coalition, not a cartel, of 39 New York City unions have spoken up in support of casting directors. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. They've been fighting for this for years. Now they're getting down to brass, you know, tactics. They're really not messing around anymore. We're going to have to see what happens. It's going to be a tough fight. You know, they're saying they're ready to work on shows, but if you want to cast a show headed to Broadway or even do a reading, you're going to have to work with our union. That's what we want. And their argument is we're talking about like 40 people on Broadway. It's not going to break Broadway. You know, you've just had a record grossing year. Don't tell us you're going to break the bank by letting us have health care and not have to choose between, you know, if you want a job in the theater and be a casting director, you know, it becomes impossible to get healthcare. So they want to be able to just have the same rights as everybody else. And here's what I love. They've spoken up and said they're ready to do any show, anything. But when you call them and try to book them, they say you have to talk to my union. You have to book through them. That happened with a reading of a musical version of Norma Rae. The people behind Norma Rae, they're working on a musical version of that movie. They dumped the casting director, the very well-known Cindy Tolan, because of this fight. It's Norma Rae, about a woman trying to unionize a thing, and they're trying to keep them from having basic worker rights. And it's Norma Rae. My God. I mean, the irony is just thick on the ground.
Yes. Look up Norma Rae. If you don't know, it's a 40-year-old film. Look up Norma Rae, and you'll be like, oh, I get it. It is kind of ironic.
That's stupid.
I kind of wonder what it's like in the United Kingdom or in Australia or in France. Now, France, I get they're probably unionized already. But, you know, in the United Kingdom where they have the West End and in Sydney, Australia, where they have theater and they put on Broadway musicals, I wonder if they're all unionized in those in other countries. I would imagine.
In the theater world, let us know.
Yeah, let us know. Now, speaking of other countries, which country exports more physical books than any other in the world? Any other country in the world? Is it the U.S.? Is it China? That would seem kind of logical. Is it Germany? The surprising answer is the United Kingdom. They have a 17% share of world exports, followed closely by the US with 16%, Germany at 10%, and China at 8%. And of course, as I said, it would make sense that China would export. Actually, no, it wouldn't because, you know,
there are Chinese people all over the world. So these are countries that export physical books, meaning you want to read a British book and it hasn't been sold in this territory, then you might order it from the UK. Or if you're a Chinese person who speaks Mandarin and Cantonese, you probably don't have easy access to those language books, just like you don't have easy access to French and German and Spanish. So you might get them from China or Japan or Germany or Spain and so on. So UK is really punching above its weight here.
Well, yeah, and all of this export information is one of the interesting facts detailed in a new report commissioned by the UK's Publisher Association. Overall, the British publishing industry added £3.2 billion to the overall economy in 2016, which is like $1 trillion, by the way. And with their creative industries, including movies, music, sports, among others, they added up to £92 billion and growing at twice the rate of the economy as a whole. Now you know why Cineworld purchased Regal. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. You know, they're punching above their weight. They're really contributing to the economy as a whole. So it's a great category that the British government should make sure they take care and protect and support, because they're really helping the economy overall.
Now, this next story, when I saw it in our lineup, I thought, well, wait a second. Didn't we already do this story? Because it's about AT&T being sued for antitrust. AT&T says no one should worry about anti-competitive business after they merge with Time Warner. It wouldn't be in their interest, so it'll never happen. No way, not even when net neutrality is killed in a couple of days. But a small Texas company called Entouch says they're already violating antitrust. AT&T, that is already violating antitrust. It involves a regional sports channel that has exclusive rights to the Houston Astros and the Houston Rockets. Right now, AT&T charges its own subsidiary a huge premium for the channel, and they insist that no one else can be charged less than the subsidiary. This ensures that no other competitor can come into the market and offer a TV package with those essential sports teams on them. This twist on a most favored nation status could have significant implications if it goes to trial. Big deal or big whoop?
So you were saying you heard about this case before. What do you think?
Well, no, I mean, I heard that, you know, AT&T and Time Warner, they were being sued for antitrust over their merger. Okay, I thought this is what the story would entail. But no, it's a completely different antitrust story involving AT&T, which kind of underscores the point that this deal between AT&T and Time Warner should not go through, especially if you're going to kill net neutrality.
Right, and I love the way they pervert the most favored nation status into a way to kill competition and keep other people out. That was clever.
Yeah, I've always been, most favored nations, don't get me started on them. You know,
okay.
Negotiating virtual print fee deals for the exhibition industry, it's basically a way of saying, I'm not going to collude. You're going to do it for me. So, in other words, I'm not going to go and talk to all of my competitors and kind of agree on a price to sell at. Instead, the buyer will do it for me. The buyers will go and price everything out, and they will actually wind up getting the lowest price. And then if there's another low price, I will get that same price. Or another high price, I will get that high price.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's talk about J.K. Rowling for a second, because in a teaser for Inside Baseball, okay, this is what we're kind of edging into Inside Baseball, author J.K. Rowling is defending the casting of Johnny Depp in the next Fantastic Beasts film. During Depp's divorce from actress Amber Heard, he was accused of domestic abuse. However, when Everything came to an agreement when the two parties came to an agreement. As often happens, it included a statement from both that said, quote, there was never any intent of physical or emotional harm, end quote, by either party. Whether that means it was lawyerly jousting or Heard didn't want to drag it all into court and would rather get on with her life is impossible to know. Rowling says they were concerned and thought long and hard and considered recasting Depp. She appreciates the valid objections some have made, but since both Depp and Heard have entered an agreement to protect their privacy, she and the producer stood by their choice to keep Depp. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop because every case is different, so it doesn't lead to, oh, well, if they chose this, that means everyone can ignore any allegations about anything. It's a difficult call, though. I mean, there were photos online of alleged physical abuse. They appeared in People magazine and elsewhere. There were statements from two witnesses. When people get divorced, there often is that sort of agreement, and just to get out of on with your life, that's often what happens. You just say, you know, it happened with Trunk and one of his wives. But they divorced for $7 million, which sounds like chump change when you're talking about the amount of money Johnny Depp is worth, or at least seemed to be. And she donated it all to the American Civil Liberties Union and Children's Hospital of Los Angeles. So, you know, should you not cast Johnny Depp ever again in anything? I don't know, but this was not an easy call. And that's kind of the new world we're in now.
He should have just made the donation directly and he could have gotten a tax write-off.
Very funny.
All right. That wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, as we promised. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, once again, for a record, I don't even know, umpteenth time, we're going to be talking about sexual harassment in Hollywood and apparently the larger world.
That's right. Two pieces that were from the larger world were sort of interesting. The Harvard Business Review had a piece on the economic impact of sexual harassment, how we all pay a price when women are forced out of industries, curtail their career, their ideas are not heard or listened to, they give up and go into a new business or give up and go back into private life. So I thought that was an interesting take on the case. But even more importantly, Time Magazine, you know, print is dead, right? And yet people still care who the Time Magazine person of the year is. Trump thought it was him. And in a way, he's sort of right in a weird way. It's not Trump, but it is the silence breakers, the people who have spoken up and become visible to talk about sexual harassment, assault, and rape, and are certainly not changing the culture permanently yet, but making big waves throughout the entire country, if not the world.
Yeah, I mean, because, look, you mentioned Trump, you know, certainly he mentioned that he thought he was going to be it and he turned down the offer. And they said, well, we never made you the offer. It would have been the second time he was person of the year, second year in a row. But other than Trump, you know, as far as headline makers this year, certainly you have to go with, you know, all of this sexual harassment news and the people that both broke the story, the journalists that broke the story and the people that they were writing about.
And the hope that when they do single out something as the news story of the year is not just that it made a lot of headlines, but that it will have a long-term impact. And when you look back 20, 50 years, you go, yeah, that was a good call.
Right. Precisely. I mean, certainly, right. I don't want to name some of the names who have been at Time's Person of the Year because you have a little eyebrow.
Well, that doesn't mean they're good people. It just means they're the most impactful. Certainly, Hitler is a perfectly reasonable choice, as he was one year. You know, it doesn't mean they're good people. It just means they have had a big impact on the world that year. And
yes,
perhaps something that will be lasting that we'll talk about for a long time to come.
Well, I don't know how you want to handle this week's batch of news. To me, the most troubling is the whole Al Franken thing. And I think a lot of people found it troubling, and to the point where on Saturday Night Live, and I didn't want to play the bit where, you know, they had kids on sitting on Santa's lap and they were, instead of asking for presents, they wound up talking about sexual harassment cases. And one of them said, well, I guess what we've learned is if you deny everything, you get to keep your job. And if you apologize, you don't get to keep your job.
Right. So Al Franken resigned from the U.S. Senate. More women came forward, including a female congressional Democratic aide, talking about him forcibly kissing her. And that was sort of the break in the dam. And a number of top female senators spoke out and called on him to resign. He could have stayed and waited for an ethics committee hearing. We debated and argued about whether that was shortchanging justice and whether they were, you know, bum rushing him to the door or whether they should have let the process continue. Other people I've had were complaining, you know, Democrats are idiots. Republicans would never, you know, what he did doesn't rise to the level of having to lose your job. He didn't trade it for, you know, better work or, you know, an advancement in the job or the office. It wasn't, you know, therefore it shouldn't include. Most of this was before he was a senator. So it's not an easy one. People debate and argue. All of these are touchy to the people involved, aren't they?
Well, yeah, especially when the quote unquote final straw was a woman who came forth with a claim that it was an anonymous accusation.
The congressional aide, the female congressional yes. Democratic aide.
Yes, uh-huh. It was on. It wasn't a congressional aide. She was a Democratic operative who was kind of an assistant to, you know, a Minnesota Democratic.
But they spoke to her boyfriend and they spoke to other people who he related the story to at the time, I thought.
I don't know about that. I just know that it was an anonymous.
Well, but people, so you think unless they speak up and give their name, that it's nothing that you need to listen to?
Not necessarily. I think each case is independent, but I will say this. I think that people's entire lives are being ruined now. If you're going to do that, then you should probably be named.
Well, no. He chose to step down. He didn't have to step down. If he wanted to fight, he could. If he wanted to clear his name. What he said was, you know, if you're accused of something shameful, Sperling, normally you would say, dear God, no, I didn't do that. What does Al Franken say? He says, I don't remember that. What do you mean you don't remember it? It's like, I didn't do it. If you accuse me of raping a child, I will say, dear God, that didn't happen. I forcibly kissed someone. Dear God, that didn't happen. I did not do that. Not, I don't remember that. Or I remember it differently. So that's mostly what we're talking about. But, you know, he could have fought it. He could have stayed and had the ethics hearing. He chose not to. His fellow colleagues abandoned him and they called on him to resign. But that's not the same as, you know, throwing someone in jail or saying they're guilty until proven innocent. You're saying, I feel your behavior is raised to the level where you're not a fit person to serve in public office. And they spoke out. I'm sure he feels betrayed. He was angry. It was an upsetting turn of events for him. A guy that was being touted as possibly a presidential candidate, frankly.
Well,
now he's out
on
his keister, as he puts it ironically, whereas the guy who has 14 women charging him with far worse is still in office.
Right. And in this case, in our country right now, in the United States, for those of you listening outside the United States, you have a person from one party resigning over things he said mostly did not happen.
Sexual misconduct.
Whereas another has the full backing of their party on the other side for running for Senate. So,
well, they did just lose a Republican congressman with a bizarre stories of repeatedly asking his female aides to take $5 million so they could surrogate carry his child.
Yeah.
Very bizarre story. But anyway, here's a roundup of what we know in Hollywood. Robert Knepper is an actor from Prison Break, best known for that show. Four women have come forward with allegations of sexual misconduct, assault, and rape, which he adamantly denies. Disney has another problem. A top exec in their music division, a head of publishing in their music division, has been charged by police with three counts of child sex abuse, one involving a girl who was 15 and another involving a girl who was 11. Danny Masterson of That 70s Show was fired from a Netflix series over rape allegations. Four women have come forward accusing him of sexual misconduct to rape. Celebrity chef Mario Batali has just stepped down from the TV show The Chew and all his other businesses, while stories of at least four women coming forward talking about sexual misconduct by him have just exploded out this morning.
Well, and what's interesting about that is here, they're all anonymous, okay, all the allegations. And he said, look, they're all anonymous. I don't know who these women are. But you know what? That is actually the behavior being described is actually the way I used to behave. I could see that actually being who I was. And so, you know what? I've got to change.
The head of the New York City Ballet, Peter Martins, is accused of abusing his power. He's allegedly known for sleeping with dancers. You sleep with him, you get a better role. In 1992, he was charged with third-degree assault against his wife, which was a misdemeanor, and it was dropped. But now he has been suspended by the New York City Ballet where they look into allegations of him abusing his power dealing with the dancers and other people in his business. The editor of the Paris Review has resigned, Lauren Stein, amid investigation into his sexual misconduct towards staff and writers. He told the New York Times, at times in the past, I blurred the personal and the professional in ways that were, I now recognize, disrespectful of my colleagues and our contributors, and that made them feel uncomfortable or demeaned. I am very sorry for any hurt I caused them. WNYC, a big radio station here in the city that syndicates shows all over the country. They have suspended two long-term people, Leonard Lopate, or Lopate, I don't know how to say his name, and Stephen Schwartz, both of them with allegations of sexual misconduct. Not really spelled out to us. There's an investigation underway, and they've merely been suspended. A friend of mine said, well, do you agree with the New York City Ballet? Do you agree with the WNYC, who was furious about the Al Franken treatment by Dems? And I said, well, they're investigating. What are they supposed to do? You're saying they shouldn't even investigate? If allegations come forward and they seem even remotely credible, you have to make sure the person can't abuse their power while you investigate, and you investigate. What else can they do? I'm like, what are they supposed to do? Not investigate? I mean, I don't know what you're supposed to say when multiple guests and employees come forward complaining about your radio show hosts. I think what you do is you suspend them, make sure they can't abuse their power, and you investigate. And if you're lucky and you love and respect them, you will clear them and say, there was no truth to it, and we're happy to welcome them back with a cleared name. And if there is truth to it, you take the proper steps. What else can you do?
Look, this whole thing is foreign to me. This whole...
Well, here's the point. You're at the New York City Ballet, and multiple people have approached you and made complaints against one of your employees. What do? You investigate.
Right.
What else? You invest. Well, that's what they're doing.
And if there are criminal, criminal activity, you hand it over to the police.
Right. If you have any remote suspicion that it could be, even the allegation is involving criminal activity, you call the police. Getting a dancer to sleep with you in order to give her a better role is not a crime. It's just inappropriate for your job. Rape and assault obviously is. So, yeah, it's not your job to clear people's names from criminal charges. If anything is criminal, you pick up the phone and call the police. But as far as your business, you have to investigate. And I said, well, what do you want them to do? They suspend them and they investigate. What else can they do? That's the appropriate thing to do, right? And the fact is that we probably know for decades they knew and ignored. Right? These aren't coming out of the blue. In most cases, you know, like Mario Batali, New York Times is quoting people who say, oh, yeah, he's totally, you know, multiple people saying, oh, my God, that's his reputation. Incredibly lewd, inappropriate comments, groping, touching, grabbing. This is what this guy has done for many, many years. This isn't news to anyone, apparently, who works around him.
Well, isn't that usually the case?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's upsetting. Dustin Hoffman, another woman came forward to him with a detailed account of his sexual misconduct during death of a salesman. I found her story fascinating and interesting, and we linked to it in our show notes. Terry Crews of Everybody Hates Chris is suing the agent, Adam Bennett, and William Morris Endeavor over the assault he suffered. Jeffrey Rush is fighting back. He has one anonymous complaint filed at a theater company in Sydney, and he doesn't know what the complaint is or who has made it or what it involves. And he's angry and upset and trying to defend his name. He's saying, please don't make a rush to judgment. This is just one person, and I don't even know what they're complaining about. And he is suing the Daily Telegraph, though, over defamation, though I don't understand how that's going to play out, because they were simply reporting the facts of the case that he's been accused of some unknown case, and the Sydney Theatre Company is trying to investigate it. So I'm not sure why he thinks he's going to win a lawsuit against the Daily Telegraph.
Well, I guess the question is, did the Daily Telegraph report something that the Australian...
Did they have actual details that weren't anywhere else? I didn't notice. I didn't find any, but maybe that's the case.
In other words, is the Sydney... is it the Sydney Theatre Group Company or the Australian... It's in Sydney. Is that theatre company investigating because of a Daily Telegraph piece? And if so...
Oh, no. This it didn't begin with the Daily Telegraph piece, as far as I know.
Okay.
They received the complaint directly. I may be not remembering that correctly, but that's my understanding. And again, every case is different. With Al Franken, for example, I was like, well, come on. Well, let's hold on. It's obviously not cool that you grope a woman when you're doing a public photo, but if that's the worst we have, and that doesn't mean that's acceptable, but it does mean that's something that you could apologize for, change your behavior, and move on and keep your job. I was hoping it would remain that way, and unfortunately it didn't. You know, so every case is different, and every time there's new information, you got to rethink it. Louis C.K. is buying back his film, I Love You, Daddy, which was supposed to have an Oscar run and be a big end-of-the-year hopeful. He'd been flying high. That certainly isn't the case. And it's so big, so broad, that the British pantomime industry is rethinking some of their routines. If you're in the UK, you know that every year come the holiday time, they have the pantos, where basically they take a story like Snow White or Cinderella or Sleeping Beauty, and they have a raucous, silly, family-friendly show where they sometimes have sexual innuendos for the parents that go over the kids' heads. It's naughty in the most silly way and friendly and family and silly. And there's a big celebrities involved. And usually a male star is playing one of the female leads in a big, broad, funny, silly way, dressed up as a woman. It's all good fun. And they're saying, oh, they've rethinked at least one thing in the pantos done all over the country. There's often a bit from Morecambe and Wise where one of the men peeks up under the skirt of one of the women. And they said, yeah, you know, we're going to cut that. They're saying no to peeking up skirts, but yes to innuendo. So we're not going to get rid of innuendo. That's the heart of panto. It's silly and kids don't even know what's going on. It's fun. It's harmless, we feel. And one producer said, quote, referring to a fairy story about Dick Whittington, which is a historic figure who the fairy tale is that he used his cats to catch rats. And that's how he dragged himself out of poverty into his fame and fortune. But anyway, so you get the reference. This producer says, quote, do you believe you're going to come to the Palladium and see a fairy tale about Dick Whittington and not have a joke about Dick? That would be a sad day, I think, as you can't get too hung up on it. You can't not have a joke about his name, Dick.
It's Richard, in case you're wondering.
Yeah, it's Richard, yes. So yeah, everybody's struggling in every possible way. Friends are arguing and fighting. What you can do, at least people like Johnny Halliday and Shashi Kapoor won't have to hear any more about sexual harassment.
But that's not necessarily a good thing. That's because Johnny Halliday, he's known as the French Elvis. He died at the age of 74.
That's right. He's kind of a cool guy. He covered songs by Elvis and others at first. He became the French rock and roll star. He did a live show in 1960 that caused a near riot. He gave the Jimi Hendrix Experience their first live gig, opening up for him. He sold 110 million records. And he even segued into film, making a lot of bad movies, but eventually getting pretty good and even winning a César for Best Actor for his film, The Man on the Train. So, you know, he had a great long career. His fame never translated to the U.S., but he is an icon in France.
And who is Shashi Kapoor?
Well, he's a huge, legendary Indian actor in Bollywood. He died at 79. And at one point from the 70s to the 80s, he was appearing in like 10 films a year. Literally, he would like shoot a scene here, then jump to another set, then jump to another. I mean, he was shooting multiple films at the same time. He's appeared in Merchant Ivory films. He was in Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. If you saw him, you would recognize him. And one of the big things he did was he broke a taboo by kissing a woman on screen. He did that in a 1978 film directed by his brother Raj called Satyam Shivam Sundaram. And it was, he did something that had been banned in Hindi films for years. He shared an on-screen kiss, several actually, with his female co-star Zeenat Aman. And that was a huge barrier falling for the Bollywood film industry. They still don't kiss much, but they did it and it is now possible. So he died at 79. He's a legendary Bollywood film actor, crossed over into Western films like Sammy and Rosie Get Laid and Merchant Ivory. Great long career, and sad to see him go.
And, you know, now instead of kissing, they just break into song.
They did that then as well.
And they're usually not folk songs, by the way.
That's right. You're segueing to a fact of somebody pointing out on Twitter, sending to us, about my comment about why would the Grammys nominate Amy Mann, the pop star, in the Best Folk Album category.
Now, this was Raul Buril again on Twitter, at Showbiz Sandbox, and he said, is Michael thinking of a different Amy Mann? Because Amy Mann is folk. In fact, on allmusic.com and in some of Amazon listings, she's listed as folk.
Well, she's listed in like 18 categories.
Yeah, well, that's part of the problem. And I noticed that, I'm downloading some of the and purchasing some of the year-end best of albums. And it's like, you know, is it rap or is it R&B? You know, it's like it kind of transcends categories. I think Amy Mann is kind of one of those people.
Well, I don't think she's a folk artist in the least. But you'll find 17 categories. You know, is she rock? Is she pop? Is she, you know, it's a little alternative rock. You know, is somebody AAA or alternative American? Or are they just country? Or are they country and alternative American? Those labels get a little confusing. But when you're looking at the best folk album of the year, the Grammy Awards, her music just doesn't strike me. Not even on this particular album that she was nominated for, which I think is a nice album. I'm a big fan of hers. She started with Till Tuesday and the hit single Voices Carry. And she has a terrific solo career. She's a marvelous artist, is not the first person. Sometimes you can be a rock and roll star and record a folk album. Bob Dylan has done it. Other artists have done it where they suddenly record an album that is a folk album or a blues album. You know, specifically, they say, you know, Linda Ronstadt a pop rock star who said, I'm going to record a, you know, a mariachi album. I'm going to record a jazz album. I don't think this is that case. But I'm happy she got attention. And I'm happy Raul reached out to us. And I hope you guys will too.
Well, now, wait a second. Didn't Bob Dylan start as a folk artist?
Sure.
Okay. Yes. Well, if you are trying to reach out to us, you can do so. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well, and maybe most importantly, ways to subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find our show. Again, all of that information is on showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's ivegotaheadcold.com.
Oh, and that's actually true. Although, if you are actually trying to find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry, why not head on over to thehuffingtonpost.com or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.